Good morning. I will ask the marshal to call us in.
The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Bratfold, Judge Larkin, Judge Jessen, the Honorable Judge Diane B. Bratfold presiding.
All right, and good morning for the second time. So today's date is September 14th, 2021, and we are here at the Minnesota Court of Appeals hearing arguments via Zoom, as the notice indicated. And I see that counsel are here and present, and I know your connections have been checked. So I'll do that again quickly, but it sounds like we're in a good spot. So Mr. Vanderhayden, would you just indicate whether you can hear me?
I can, Your Honor. Thank you.
All right. And we can hear you. And how about you? Is it Ms. Grohler? How do I say your name?
It's Grohler, Your Honor. Grohler. Yes.
Okay. Thanks.
I can hear you. Thank you.
Okay. Excellent. And so I think counsel are familiar now and may well have appeared before us, before via Zoom. And although these hearings are recorded and the audio is maintained on our website. In all other respects, this case, these hearings proceed according to the rules. So you know that you have a certain amount of time. We will be asking you questions. We ask you to identify yourself before you start the argument, as well as the client you represent, and that you keep your eye on the clock because our conversations tend to go fairly quickly. And that clock should be visible to you on your screen. Let me know if it isn't. So if anything else happens during the proceedings that you would like to call to our attention, I think you have a way to do that. The court has provided you with some contact information. So with that, I think we're ready to call the first case, and Marsha, I'll have you do that.
Now calling A21-0381 in the matter of the welfare of the child of HMER and RNN parents.
And counsel for appellant, you can begin when you're ready.
May it please the court and counsel. My name is David Vanderhayden. I appear on behalf of the mother, who is also present here with me this morning. I'd like to thank the court staff for assisting my office with a technical glitch yesterday that worked out very well. Before I get started here this morning, I wanted to direct the court's attention to a typo in my reply brief at page 2, number 2, line 2. I cited Minnesota statutes 260.12H. The correct citation should be 260.012H. I apologize for that.
Thank you very much, Mr. Vanderhayden. We noted.
We respectfully submit that the decision of the district court should be reversed and remanded for the following reasons. Before I start my argument, I thought it appropriate to state to this court that this court must exercise great caution in termination proceedings, finding such action proper only when the evidence clearly mandates such a result. There's legions of case law on that standard. Every word in that standard matters. Here, the evidence does not mandate termination. Mother argues that her parental rights cannot be terminated or the statutory grounds articulated by the trial court because Olmsted County has not proven it made reasonable efforts to rehabilitate her as a parent or to reunite her with her son. I think it would be appropriate before the court makes a decision on this case, if it hasn't already done so today, is to review Minnesota Statutes 260C001, which is known as the Act. It also sets forth the purpose of laws terminating parental rights and provides that the purpose of laws relating to termination of parental rights is to ensure that reasonable efforts have been made by the social service agency to reunite the child with the child's parents in a placement that is safe and permanent. Also, under 260C001, there is more language that talks about when required and appropriate, reasonable efforts have been made by the social service agency to reunite the child with the child's parents in a home that is safe and permanent. Minnesota Statutes 260.012, duty to ensure placement, prevention, and family reunification, reasonable efforts. Sub D, reasonable efforts to prevent placement means the agency has made reasonable efforts to prevent the placement of a child in foster care by working with the family and develop and implementing a safety plan. The juvenile court.
Mr. Vanderhayden, you certainly raise a very good point, and I appreciate you starting with the issue of reasonable efforts. If you would direct us specifically to the district court finding that you're challenging and the basis for it, I guess I'm wondering, given your relying and reciting statutes, are you claiming that the district court made a legal error in its analysis as to reasonable efforts?
Your Honor, I'm to answer the court's question, thank you for the question. I'm referring to findings of fact 66, 67, and 68 made by the trial court. I'm making an argument that the court abused its discretion with respect to the legal conclusion it drew based on the evidence in the record, but I'm also arguing that each and every one of those findings are clearly erroneous.
So in what way are you claiming that the district court lacked evidence to make the findings in 66, 67, 68? I mean, I've read your brief, so I appreciate that, but I assume you want us to focus in on something in particular.
And at 66, Your Honor, the court states HHH has made reasonable efforts to rehabilitate Ms. Raptus and to reunite her with the child. That is a clearly erroneous factual finding, and it's based upon the failure to offer domestic abuse counseling or domestic violence counseling in this case. That's in 66. The last sentence thereof, Ms. Raptus would have benefited from domestic violence groups. However, Ms. Raptus did not believe she is a victim of domestic violence. That finding, from our perspective, is clearly erroneous.
And help me understand why that's true. The district court did spend some time responding to this criticism of its order in the response to your motion to amend, and indicated that because mother denies that she is a victim and the court is obligated to provide realistic, one of the factors is realistic, reasonable efforts, that the district court interpreted mother's denial of domestic abuse in her relationship with DT as a rejection or refusal to participate in domestic violence.
Judge, again, thank you for the question. My answer to that question is that pursuant to 260C 212, the out-of-home placement here was never clearly explained to the respondent, to the mother, and there's no evidence in the record that Ms. Stews or anyone else, for that matter, ever discussed the need for domestic violence treatment with appellant to support its argument that it made reasonable efforts towards reunification. Your Honors, the case plan is deficient because it is not clear and specific. It did not exactly state what appellant needed to do. It does not state how long appellant needed to do anything. It does not state how progress was to be measured. The case plan does not include any reunification steps that will take place when based on appellant's compliance with the case plan. The county has not shown by clear and convincing evidence that their efforts were reasonable. Accepting a clear victim of domestic abuse assertion that she didn't need help is simply unacceptable and it's unreasonable. What I was suggesting should have occurred in this case, the county should have gone to court, sought a court order. The trial court even inquired about that. What could I do or what could a court do under these circumstances? The county should have petitioned or motioned the court to require her to secure domestic abuse. Your Honor, this is not a tangential issue in this case. This is what called the attention of the agency to this family was domestic abuse in the middle, the beginning and the end, but yet the county did nothing to implement, encourage, require domestic violence services as part of its case plan.
That's an interesting argument, the idea that the district court should have ordered the mother to participate in some sort of domestic abuse training, education, therapy, in order to change her mind. It is, you know, an extensive record here that the mother not only denies that she's a victim, but denies that in particular, her husband is the one who abused her or has ever abused anyone, even though he is a registered predatory offender and currently in jail serving a sentence. And that mother indicates that she plans to reunite with her adjudicated convicted abuser when he is released. So the record is pretty detailed and complicated in terms of mothers. It's too simplistic to say she simply denies that she's a domestic abuse victim. It's more than that. So in light of that, I guess I'm looking to you for some kind of precedent that would suggest that a district court must order a parent into domestic, and maybe I just am unaware of that, you know, and please enlighten me.
Your Honor, to answer your question, I think you need to look at what the problem was in this family. The problem was domestic violence and mother's, the problems were domestic violence and mother's mental health. The county clearly should not have accepted a victim of domestic violence's, a victim of domestic violence who says, I don't need treatment. I mean, in the chemical dependency world, it's well known that is a fairly typical response from someone who's a victim of domestic abuse. And with respect to the development of the record, Your Honor, from my standpoint, all that does is underscore these are social service professionals who are to assist this family in reuniting. And in some ways, the victim is incapable of logical and rational thinking about being the victim of domestic violence. And that's where a professional social worker comes into play. And in the step that needed, I mean, if she went into a counselor and had a domestic violence inventory and the counselor said, I just can't work with her. She's impossible. She's too far gone. That's one thing, but she doesn't even get a referral to a domestic violence counselor. And in this case, Your Honor, that's unreasonable.
If I may, Mr. Van Hayden, I would understand your argument and would resonate more with me if domestic violence was the only or the predominant problem here. I mean, the way I read this record, so help me with this, is that, you know, the mother had, you know, pretty substantial mental health problems. And I think the county was trying to make sure that they stabilized those before addressing, you know, moving on to deal with a number of other issues, including parenting ability and some of the domestic violence issues. I mean, why was it, you know, error for the county to take that approach? That seems to me to be pretty reasonable, given what I understand in the record is that, you know, at most her mental health issues started to stabilize right around the time of trial.
Well, Your Honor, I don't know that, I believe that stabilizing her mental health would go hand in hand with, I'm not a domestic violence professional, but I believe those two objectives, securing domestic abuse counseling for a clear victim of domestic abuse, and at the same time, stabilizing your mental health, I believe those are consistent with one another and need not be staged. But Your Honor, to answer your question, that is how another reason the plan that was the home placement plan was fatally defective here. That plan should have talked about that very question you just raised. How are we going to, as an agency and in this plan, devise a way to deal with domestic abuse and stabilize your mental health? That is the precise reason that plan under Minnesota statutes 260C 212 is deficient. The case plan does not tell her that she needs to do anything. It says it has conclusions, laudable conclusions. You're to maintain a safe, criminal-free household for Mr. For the child. How else is she going to do that if she doesn't get domestic violence training and isn't pushed or pushed along that path, Your Honor? It's just not going to happen. And it didn't happen in this case. Also, I want the court to consider that with respect to mental health, the whole record here is clear that my client, and this is undisputed, did everything the agency and the plan, the home placement plan, required her to do with respect to addressing her mental health. She went to transitions, voluntarily put herself into transitions, which is a Mayo Clinic program, and successfully completed that program. There's evidence she went to every meeting, did well, got a very nice summary discharge. She did everything with the exception of an issue with the authorizations for release of information.
I was going to say, I need to hear from you, and there's only 1 minute left. I mean, mother revoked her consent.
I was going to just say that.
Right. So tell me how we get around that. I mean, that is a strong, if you'd let me finish. So that is a strong reason in support of the district court's conclusion that in that respect, a significant one, mother failed on the case plan with regard to treating her mental health and following the recommendations.
Well, with respect to that release, my client testified that she didn't revoke the releases and that the county had access to that information. So that's not a clear cut. And frankly, I don't understand all the facts surrounding that. But initially, she did sign those authorizations. And it wasn't until the very tail end of it, the tail end of this chronology here, that she revoked those, but it was late in the game, and it was because of a contact the social worker had with her treating psychologist, Ms. Zebart.
All right, so Mr. Vanderhaeden, thank you very much, and I appreciate that you're still probably mid-thought in terms of your argument, but fortunately, we do have 5 minutes for your rebuttal, and so you'll be able
thank
to
you.
Pick it up at that point. So we're resetting the clock for you, Ms. Grayler and the county. We're ready to hear from you when you're ready.
Thank you. Good morning. May it please the court, opposing counsel. My name is Deb Grayler, and I represent Olmsted County Health, Housing, and Human Services in this appeal. To touch on the issue of whether domestic violence services should have been provided, I think the testimony and the record was clear on that, not only from the county social worker, the guardian ad litem, as well as Ms. McMahon, who conducted the parenting assessment. She detailed in her evaluation with the mother that the mother was inconsistent in the information that she provided at certain points, indicating that the mother's husband had abused her, and then at other times saying he was a good father and would never hurt her or the child. And again, that was one issue in this case. And as the court just touched on, mother's mental health was really probably the most significant issue in this case. Her inability to stabilize throughout the case prevented her from really understanding how her behavior and her mental health impacted the child, including the supervised parenting time incident that was testified to at the trial, where mother got so upset that she was damaging property and climbing up on the counter during a supervised visit. That was one of the services that the county provided in this case and was a very reasonable effort to attempt to reunify the child with the mother. These were pandemic conditions, and as the social worker testified, she advocated for the mother to have in-person supervised visits with her son, postponing the parenting assessment until some of those supervised visits could occur so that mother had a meaningful opportunity to see her son prior to that observation. And as the parenting evaluator testified as well, the mother could not even stay awake during that evaluation. And what the assessor observed during that parenting assessment was that the child had an insecure attachment to the mother. It was the child who continued to try to.
You said mother could not stay awake during the parenting evaluation. What I recall the notes were is that mother did fall asleep twice. I mean, for a brief period of time, but there was observed time between mother and the child. right?
Yes, yes, I mean, Your Honor.
I would I wouldn't want to go overstate what's in the report, right? So you're touching on, trying to, and I appreciate that, counsel, that you're trying to touch on all of the issues, not focus on any one of them, because obviously, as you're correct, there were many grounds for the district court's decision, and there is a connection between the mental health issues and the domestic violence issues. But I'd like you to more specifically respond to Mr. Vanderhaeghen's argument about domestic violence. You're certainly correct that the comments that mother made to the parenting assessor about domestic abuse were inconsistent. That's noted in the report, and that's not the only time that that mother was inconsistent. But as I think Mr. Vanderhaeghen's point is, why wasn't domestic violence in some forms, training, therapy, awareness, education included in mother's plan? It could be in the case plan, and why wasn't it done in conjunction with mental health, as is we often see that, right, in the court? So why didn't it happen here?
Your Honor, I believe the testimony of the social worker was that she tried to discuss that with the mother, discuss the fact that the mother's husband was not safe, and express the county's concerns about that. And mother continued to identify him as the biggest support in her life, that she was having regular contact with him, and expressed that she was not interested in domestic violence services. And so there's case law that talks about a parent cannot simply, you know, check the boxes on a case plan if it was in the case plan. You have to meaningfully engage in those services. And again, that was discussed multiple times, including, you know, here's the parenting evaluation where that's recommended again. And mother continued to express that she was not interested and did not see herself as a victim. And again, I think the fact that mother was not able to stabilize throughout this case, even if those services had been offered, would she have been able to meaningfully engage in those services? And that would not have corrected the overriding concern of mother's mental health and the fact that she did not have capacity to parent this child, as opined by the parenting evaluator during that evaluation and observation. That was also observed over time in mother's inability to, again, have those safe supervised visits with her child, and mother refusing to have video visits with the child even when those were offered, after that incident that occurred during the supervised parenting time.
So your comment about mother not stabilizing in her mental health treatment, and we've already alluded to the fact that the record is handicapped in that regard, and that we don't, mother revoked her consent to provide records. And so there is some uncertainty exactly what her path of treatment was. We definitely know she changed providers at a few different points. Would you address the argument Mr. Vanderhaeghen made, is that, you know, as mother approached trial, her mental health appeared to be stabilizing. And I think they primarily rely on the Zumbro Mental Health Services.
Well, Your Honor, the record does indicate that mother's therapist, Ms. Siebart, testified that there had been some progress just before the trial. However, that therapist also acknowledged that she was not aware that the mother had an active suicidal plan that she had discussed with a therapist at Nystrom and Associates just a couple weeks prior. And mother also testified to that as well. She testified that she had a suicide plan, and the court asked her about that. And so there's conflicting information, and I don't see how mother can get around the fact that she didn't report that information to her therapist at Zumbro Valley. And again, that evidence that has been put forward in the evaluation does not contain that information. So I don't believe that her mental health was stable at the time of the trial. And as the court noted, she had only recently reestablished services with the therapist. There was a gap in time where she wasn't seeing any therapist, had terminated Ms. Siebart because, due to that release of information, Ms. Siebart had communicated with the ongoing child protection worker and indicated what some of her concerns were. And then that release was revoked and the county was not able to obtain more information. But at the time of the trial, her mental health was definitely not stable.
So I'm just going to pause for a second. I see Mr. Vanderhayden's, at least the visual that I had. Maybe he just shut off his camera. Looks like he's still here and the microphone is on. So I'm sorry, Ms. Grayler. I just want to make sure that we're all connected. So here's my follow-up question for you. And I just am trying to clarify the record. It seems, if I'm tracking it correctly, that Ms. Zebart, you said that there was a gap in treatment. I think it ended perhaps in August before the trial. Is that right? And then there was an evaluation done by Zebart just before the trial, or maybe more like an assessment, a check-in assessment. Am I right there?
Yes, Your Honor.
All right. And then there was the Nystrom contact, and that was somewhere in that same time period, October, November, right?
I believe so, Your Honor.
And if you want to add anything else, go ahead. I just wanted to make sure I was reading the record correctly.
That is my recollection as well, that that the mother was engaged in services until August of 2020, and then there was a gap until at least late October, early November, when she reestablished some therapy services. Your Honors, I believe as well, what needs to be at the forefront here is, as the trial court noted, the decisions regarding a termination are what exists at the time of the trial. And it must appear that those are going to continue for a prolonged indeterminate period. And as the court noted, the parenting evaluator indicated that she believed it would take at least 12 to 18 months before the mother might be able to independently parent the child. There was some echo of that same or similar information from the therapists, who were not there to really provide an opinion about parenting, the mother's adult mental health therapist, but they also indicated that it would take a significant period of time for the mother to make progress in therapy. As the court is well aware, there are permanency timelines in play here that dictate how long a child can remain in out-of-home care. Children are not supposed to linger in foster care, but permanency is to be determined and established within a certain period of time. And that time frame, or those time frames that were described by the parenting evaluator and the adult mental health therapists, would go beyond that permanency timeline. And as the court found, it was in the child's best interest for the mother's rights to be terminated so that the child could be freed for adoption. At this time, if there are not additional questions, I will rely on my brief and defer on the remaining amount of time.
Are there any other questions for the panel? Okay. Thank you, Ms. Grayler. Any last concluding remarks? You're going to rest on your brief.
I will rest on my brief at this time. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. So, Mr. Vanderhayden, there we go. We've reset the clock, so you've got 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Does the court have any specific additional questions they'd like to ask
so
of me?
I'll kick it off if you don't have something, a spot you'd like to begin at. So Ms. Grayler's concluding remark, it was the opinion of both the district court based on the evidence and McMahon, the parenting evaluator, that mother did not have the capacity to parent. And the biggest specific reason, I think, was mental health, but there were other issues as well, the inability to provide a safe home, for instance. And that she definitely needed additional therapy. It would be some amount of time. So Ms. Grayler's argument, if you'd respond to that, you know, that is the district court's job, is to assess current conditions at the time of trial, and mother was not capable of parenting at the time of trial.
Thank you, Your Honor. Your Honor, I believe there is substantial evidence in the record, especially in the form of her treating healthcare professional, Ms. Zebart, who testified in no uncertain terms that the mother here, had the capacity to parent. What that goes to, Your Honor, from my perspective, is the burden. When you have a treating...
I think more accurately, Mr. Vanderhayden, Ms. Zebart testified that mother could have or might have the capacity to parent if she proceeded with additional therapy. I think,
Your Honor, I asked her on direct exam if she had I left an open question. Does Helena have the capacity to parent? And I think she answered that yes.
Okay. All right. Thank you. Go ahead.
And that's a critical distinction that goes to the burden of proof here from a expert the county hired versus a treating professional. Your Honor,
Course, counsel, you recognize with conflicting testimony, of course, the district court gets to weigh that testimony with regard to mother's capacity to parent at the time of trial.
I understand that.
Okay.
But there is substantial evidence in the record that she has had the capacity to parent, and she also spelled out some time frames that are much different than the opinion given from the parenting time assessor. Ms. Zibar testified she expected to see, for lack of a better word, I don't know the exact word, significant improvement in 6 months and something far greater than that in a year. And I think that's very, very significant. And I think all the evidence was that her mental health had stabilized, if you will, during that fall of 2020. And it came to a head right before the trial when Ms. Exhibit 91, Your Honor, is the extensive mental health evaluation that Ms. Zibart performed so that she could have some diagnostic information for the court to support her testimony, testified and found that my client's thought processes were clear and relevant, thought content within normal limits, aware of strength and orientation, fully oriented. And those are also consistent with Nystrom records that show she was in a stable condition while she had suicidal ideation from time to time, that was being well managed and was under control. And that in and of itself should not have been and I think the court relied too heavily on that factor when her treaters were well aware of that and that she was not in any danger of harming herself. I think they're mandatory reporters, and neither of those providers did anything about that. So I would respectfully suggest that on balance, the record from her treaters is that she had stabilized and was doing well with her mental health. And bear in mind, this proceeding was fast-tracked for some unbeknownst reason. In February of 2020, this started, and by July, they're filing a petition for termination, which was very rapid in the pandemic. And I'm running out of time. I got 10 seconds left. I want the court to consider the evidence in this record is that this mother, and the court ignored this for the most part, she had significant stability, secure attachment with this child for several years up until February of 2020. And then something, she had a mental break is what happened. Something happened, but that she did have a secure attachment with this child based on the evidence in this record before February of 2020.
Thank you, Mr. Vanderhaeden. We very much appreciate your summary of the evidence and as well as your focus on the issues that are important. We do appreciate both parties' briefs in this case as well as your oral arguments. Thank you. So with that, this matter is submitted to the court for its decision, and we will issue a decision within the statutory timeframe, which is expedited for this case. So thank you, counsel.
Thank you.